apologize for something a little bit late. There were some technical issues that were being sorted. In this meeting, the department will deal only with two issues. Issues that emanate the generation of the project which has led to incapacity in the department, and also the consequent management regarding fraud and corruption cases. I think we all hear about this, and we know there is a process that is being done by COPA. We are not COPA here. We just play our oversight role, what we usually do, and to get the report. And if there's something that we can see needs to be discussed within the report, then we deal with that. We also want to see what is the department doing. The department has been reporting to us previously that there are these cases, So we want to think about how they are managing that so that they can move forward. What has been said by SCOPA and the media, we are not here for that. We deal till now with what has been reported to us by the department and with what we have seen. Even in the members' case last week, for those that were not here, when this was raised, I indicated clearly we wait for the process of SCOPA to do its work, and then we get the report at a later stage. But today we're not here to do that. I hope we will deal with what is in front of us. But I also want to raise this concern. We indicated earlier this year, after the frustration that we had last year, of the report coming late, we were on the verge of cancelling this meeting yesterday. Because at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we had not yet heard the report. When we were in that special controller committee, both DG and CM, I raised the issue of the report. And at the time, both of them, they had no knowledge of the report. So next time, when we don't receive the report this time, we'll cancel the meeting. I think that must be noted. We are on the verge of canceling the meeting, especially if it was to be held between the parliamentary premises, we would have cancelled it. But we also looked at the fact that this would be a fruitless expedition because the venue has been secured outside the parliament. So next time I was all the time contacting the committee secretary, and she was saying that no report has come. So when I said to her, come to the meeting, she said no, the report has not come in. And at that time, I think it was around 4. So please, DG, DM, ensure that we get the report in time. It doesn't matter that we have to come here having read and analyze the report. We can't get the report when we come in. So on that one, we want to appeal to you again, because once said this, you said we should get the report at least 7 days before, so as we apply our mind for the report, we don't get the report just 5 hours before the start of the meeting. That one is not acceptable. So we want to again say this to you. In fact, we are instructing you now. You must get the report 7 days before the meeting. We are having a meeting again on the 18th. Before the end of today, you must get those reports. Thank you. Can we get apologies, Ms. Jordan?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to the honorable members, the DM, the DG, the team from the department and our colleagues. We have a couple of apologies. Honorable Hinken is attending a funeral today, so that's why she won't be here. Honorable Simi San and Honorable Tuako from the EFF are not able to attend due to party business. And we also have an apology from the Minister of Public Works. She is attending cabinet. Thank you, Chairman. Dr. Greening has also submitted his apology. It didn't get to our office. I'm only getting to hear about it now. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Ms. Liam? Over to you at this time.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and good morning to your good self, to the honorable members of the committee, DG and his team, the support of the committee. Good morning to everyone. Let me do the first things first, Chairperson, and profusely apologize for the judgment. We probably must also, on our side, try to strengthen our own hold and hand with respect to this matter, because I thought that it's a matter that we have discussed in the past and agreed and been reminding each other when it is coming towards the committee time. It does appear that there was a slip somewhere, and we can't truly be the ones who keep reminding people or not today. We will have to deal with that when we get back. Our apologies for that. The other apology is that I found myself today leading a team of men. which is not good. It's something that I'm looking at the DG now to sort out. Actually, people will argue that these are people coming here on the basis of their positions and responsibilities, but it means even at appointment, we not at the level at which we should be, which is also something that we are dealing with. The president in the State of the Nation address has repeatedly, both in both last year and this year, is quite vociferous in saying, let us deal with the demon of corruption, especially in the public sector. Whilst the others would argue that it takes two to ten, but we are of the view that if the ones in the public sector could live by the prescripts of our constitution in terms of honesty, in terms of commitment to uplift our people, that demon would be not at the level at which it is. And ours then is to be being given the directive and the direction by the president. Ours is to ensure that we live to realize the anti-corruption campaign, and ensuring that we rid our department of those who would want to live a life that they do not deserve. But also the issue of consequence management has been a matter that has been in the public domain for some time. That yes, sometimes we do hold investigations and reports, but consequence management is failing. It's a game that we, working together with the minister, to deal with the issue of consequence management. And therefore, that area too, we have ensured that the unit responsible for ensuring that looks at the risks of the organization works to assist us strengthen that area of constant management. Actually, this is one department where the SIU has been working in for some time because of the vulnerability of the department itself. In terms of its mandate, everybody would want to get a finger in the cookie jar and a finger in the pie. It's vulnerable in that sense, and it's prone to issues of and challenges of fraud and corruption. But we have tried to strengthen our hold on the units that we must work with, but also ensures that the SIU continues to work in the department to ensure that we uproot the demon of fraud and corruption. Much as that I've said so, Chairperson, with respect to the current cases in the department, I am yet to get a fuller briefing. One understands that there are these reports from the SIU and from the department itself, the unit, interacting and delving deeper in terms of the briefing for the meeting. One still has to really be thoroughly briefed. I know that the kind of reports go to the minister's office, and our meeting with the minister is our meetings are normally on Thursdays, and we will meet tomorrow, following up on some of the issues that would have been raised by the meeting. Mine is to ensure that we provide the units more time. I won't be long, so that they go deeper in the report, but with that understanding. I thought that also our checks and balances as government now, the systems are there to ensure that we close our net on fraud and corruption. Ours is to ensure that we follow up in terms of oversight, and we ensure that he and she who has committed acts of fraud and corruption, those are dealt with through consequence management. Therefore, I will allow DG and his team, especially that he needs to be the one that presents the submission. Our apologies once more for the late document. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. We will start with the presentation. After this, the Chair will guide us as to whether she will go straight to the one on contracts termination so that we also present to the committee. But I will allow my colleague here to take us through, and then the Chair will advise as to whether we, after this, we take the one on contracts or we engage into discussion. Thanks very much, Honourable Chair.
Thank you very much, DG, Deputy Minister, and good morning to the Chairperson and members of the committee. Chairperson, this presentation is very long, so I'll stick to present it as a story and not to read every slide and every bullet, which I don't think will do us any favors, and it will take much of the time today. If I go on to the introduction slide, Chairperson, there's quite a few areas here. We're going to cover our anti-corruption strategy, talking about the industry in which we operate and how we've approached the combating of fraud and corruption in the department. And then we talk about some of the achievements in the organization. We'll go on to the SIU and also talk about some of the proclamations that the SIU is currently effecting before we conclude with a new proclamation on emergency maintenance and some of our strategies going forward. Now, Chairperson, if you look at the industry in which we operate, we have a holistic approach towards combating fraud and corruption, given the fact that we appreciate that we can only deliver services effectively if we eliminate the high fraud risk in the department and the environment in which we operate. That given the combined annual property budget of exceeding 20 billion rands per annum that we procure through our property business, we are not immune to fraud and corruption. In fact, our sector is also vulnerable to bid rigging. We find bid rigging is quite a prominent type of fraud. There's credential misrepresentation, there's collusion and collusive tendering, and bribery and also fraudulent misdemeanors. Now, when one looks at the amount of money lost in corruption in government, the National Treasury estimates is 30 billion annually lost to corruption, and the CIDB itself has reviewed 500 billion of spending on goods and services in the 13-14 financial year, and this is very revealing, Chairperson and members of the committee, and that the CIDB is saying something, and the conclusions very much reflect some of our challenges. They are saying that public sector construction personnel do not understand the importance of what they did. There's inadequate skills, there's high staff turnover, no separation of responsibilities between technocrats and political office bearers. There's no consequences for those who fail to perform appropriately. There are cumbersome regulations and policies, and also a difficulty of balancing transformation with getting the work done with the right quality, at the best prices, and on time. Now, in that regard, we developed our own turnaround strategy in the department, and we established an anti-corruption unit within a new branch called the governance branch, and this has been then the main driver of anti-corruption in the department. And the anti-corruption unit, working with other elements in the organization, has then driven the cabinet policy of January 2002, where the public service anti-corruption strategy was issued, and departments were then required to establish a minimum capacity to investigate allegations of fraud and corruption and to deal with it. And we established the anti-corruption unit. Now, Chairperson, what happened since is that recently government established the Inter-Ministerial Committee, which instructed the anti-corruption task team in the JCPS cluster to develop a new anti-corruption strategy. And what has transpired, Chairperson, is that the National Anti-Corruption Strategy is now new. This is the basis upon which corruption is now dealt with in government. And what we're saying is that we need to promote citizen empowerment. There's no longer a narrow approach to fighting corruption. There's an all-of-society approach that we need to promote citizen empowerment and sustainable partnerships between all stakeholders. One, we need to also advance the professionalization and performance management of employees in the public service. Second, thirdly, we need to enhance and capacitate governance, oversight, and compliance functions in departments, which are found to be lacking. And fourthly, we need to improve the integrity and credibility of the procurement system through which much of the fraud and corruption then evolves. Fifth, we need to strengthen the resourcing, coordination, and independence of the dedicated anti-corruption agencies, which is then the SIU, the Hawks, and the other elements within the law enforcement community. And then we also need to protect vulnerable sectors that are prone to corruption and unethical practices with effective risk management. And that effective risk management then is very important for us, because that's our key driver in dealing with corruption. This is simply the regulatory framework. So, Chairperson, what we've done in the department is we are taking proactive measures. These proactive measures are dealt with through two elements. We have an anti-corruption strategy, which we review every 3 years, and we have an annual plan for the anti-corruption plan. And what we do is we have two types of measures, proactive and reactive measures. Proactive is fraud risk management that we embark upon, especially in our vulnerable areas. And we also have detection, which is through whistleblowing and reporting mechanisms. And this is the mechanism through which we detect corruption in the department and we carry out investigations. Then it's in the right, which is reactive. Then we also have resolutions, which we improve internal controls and deal with disciplinary matters through our labor relations unit, as well as criminal and civil matters through the SIU and the law enforcement agencies. Now, if I move forward with fraud risk management, Chairperson, this has been a key element of what we do in recent years, given the public protector, as well as the Audit General, a number of adverse reports regarding fraud in the department, and we've developed fraud risk management strategies. And in fact, In terms of our strategy, at the end of the 5 years, we had hoped to reduce fraud risk by 85% through a fraud risk index. And we've embarked on many initiatives, and this just represents the journey that we undertook 5 years ago to develop fraud risk activities in the department. And when one looks at the fraud prevention framework, we identify fraud risk at a strategic and operational level in the department. We're also involving all our businesses and our branches on the basis that branches responsible for resources must undertake fraud risk management, and branches are responsible for implementing fraud risk prevention plans within their respective areas of responsibility, and then we develop internal controls in that particular area. And this is where we focus, Chairperson, and we start to get into the heart of the presentation. On slide 16 is that currently the DPW has 10 high fraud risks identified through the fraud risk process. The first one is abuse of unscheduled maintenance. This is a so-called emergency unplanned maintenance. Secondly, the collusion between DPW officials and contractors is on the rise. Thirdly, inflation of prices and scope of work by contractors. Conflict of interest, where staff members have some kind of interest in bidding companies. The irregular award of tender contracts. Six is construction project mismanagement, which is big. Seven is duplicate payments to service providers, which we've uncovered quite a lot of recently. Number eight is cover coating, where you have several companies owned by the same person bidding for the same contract. Nine is fronting and credential misrepresentation that seeks to defeat the PPP system, where you have credential misrepresentation. And also what's emerging is the illegal transfer of state properties, where in our department we've already uncovered more than 20 state-owned properties that were illegally transferred into private hands, including the land where we had hoped to build the Pan African Parliament was sold illegally to a private company. Then moving from there, Chairperson, these 10 risks is what informs our processes. We then focus heavily on the code of conduct in the public service, and we also have a number of mechanisms to which fraud is reported. We promote the website where there's a talk to minister, talk to DG, and we also have the anonymous reporting through the anti-corruption hotline, and we receive leads through all of them through which we investigate allegations of fraud and corruption. Then moving from there into the investigations, Chairperson, with that particular theoretical background, this is what we've done in the last 4 to 5 years. And a lot of the investigations in the earlier years on slide 20 was conducted in recent years because we inherited a major backlog in the department. So all this work was done mainly in the last 4 years. We registered 293 cases. We finalized 256. 12 of them are in the internal reporting stage. 6 are still in the fieldwork stage. 19 have been referred to the SIU, given the fact that the SIU has over a period of time had a number of proclamations and deferred the investigation to them. Of those 293 investigations and those that were completed, these are the outcomes on slide 21, and these are the types of allegations that we had: allegations of fraud in 109 incidents, fraud or corruption, 85 allegations of tender irregularities, 48 of financial misconduct, 16 lease irregularities, 20 human resource appointment irregularities, 10 project mismanagement irregularities, 3 security breaches, and 2 incidents of fraudulent selection of EPWP beneficiaries. That was the nature and the categorization of those 293 allegations. Now, Chairperson, if I move on to the next slide, then this reflects the outcomes of the investigations that were completed. We made 325 recommendations out of our completed investigations, completed recommendations to commence with disciplinary proceedings against affected individuals. Of those, in terms of consequence management, 288 were finalized, and they resulted in 13 dismissals, 1 demotion, 40 final written warnings, 60 written warnings, 21 suspensions without pay, 11 verbal warnings, 24 retirements or resignations before sanction was passed. These could also easily, Chairperson, be added to dismissals, the 13 dismissals, that you have the tendency for individuals to resign before a sanction is passed, because what it does is 10 states, therefore, the humiliation of a dismissal. Then I moved to the 112 was not charged or they were not found not guilty. So this is our fair system where individuals had then provided evidence to the chairperson that mitigated the charges against them. And then 37 are pending at this point in time. Moving on to the next slide, chairperson, slide number 23. Slide 23 refers to the criminal referrals. These are referrals to the steps where we detect criminality. We are then obliged to refer it directly to the steps for further investigation and for criminal prosecution. And we've referred 46 such cases to the steps, most of which have yet to appear in court. In fact, chairperson, one of the examples we've used is our Pretoria Regional Office, where we received a tip-off from a service provider or contractor who complained that he was owed 6 million, and our Pretoria Office required 100,000 rand for every million rand before effecting payment, so we know why we sometimes don't pay in 30 days. And the service provider complained to us, and we arranged with the police to track the individual, and the service provider handed over a brown envelope of 50,000 to our staff member in the office, and the person was immediately arrested and faced disciplinary action in the department and was dismissed. But this matter is yet to appear in court. So you see our criminal justice system is a black backlog and some challenges. Moving forward from there, chairperson, it's also important to deal with the human element, that investigation by itself is not a panacea. And what we do, we have had 262 fraud awareness presentations in the department in the last few years. And what we do during these presentations, we appeal to the moral conscience of individuals and ask them to do their part. We share with them the latest developments in the field of fraud and corruption and unethical behavior. We talk about pressing issues that require management intervention, issues of unethical behavior. We share with them the impact of fraud and corruption and their responsibility to detect it and to also report it. So we work with the staff and we engage the entire department in the strategy of making people aware of their responsibility and to win them over. Then, chairperson, the issue of lifestyle audits is obviously very much in the public space after the announcement by the President already in 2018. Our sense is that government has not moved with the speed expected to conduct lifestyle audits. It would appear that the regulatory hurdles are delaying the commencement of lifestyle audits. Because lifestyle audit is an invasive process. And if you're not a suspect, many people will decline to undergo a lifestyle audit. So I believe they're dealing with regulatory hurdles. But what we're doing in the department, we're commencing with a voluntary process. And we've asked the SIU to assist us to build capacity in that regard. And we hope the process will commence in April. We've made a commitment that it will commence in April, which is next month. We'll start with a lifestyle audit process in April 2020. Moving beyond the lifestyle audit is also ethics. That we have established an ethics framework in the department to promote adherence to the code of conduct and also as a whole to develop a new ethics foundation in the department. Is to appeal to the moral consciousness of all our staff and to make everybody aware that we are there to be public servants first and everything else second and third. That we are not there to drain the fiscus, that our country is facing challenging times, and we don't want to be part of that history that brought everything to its knees. Because we really need, especially that the compensation budgets are being reduced, we need to get more out of our people in order to deliver our mandate. So the integrity management framework and ethics function is there to drive the turnaround in the reputation and the level of service delivery in the department. But this is in the pipeline. We've communicated the DG wishes to establish an ethics function, and we have an ethics framework which EXCO has supported. We now need to put the warm bodies in place in order to appoint an ethics officer and to drive the ethics function. And then moving over to consequence management and the ethics management unit, we are also developing and putting in place, at the request of the minister, and a consequence management unit. Now, chairperson, you know, consequence management is the responsibility of every manager. So this unit here is not intended to duplicate functions in the department, but to oversee the working of the consequence management function in the department, to ensure that every manager implements or carries out their responsibility to bring about consequence management in the event of failure in any way. For example, we appear before the committee every quarter, and we report underperformance. This consequence management unit will make sure that every supervisor takes action against individuals and branches for underperformance. If we find that our CFO reports an 80% achievement for payments in 30 days, the consequence management unit will oversee that the other 20% are answering and for reasons why they have not made payments on time and that action is taken to delinquents in that regard. So it's an intervention, probably a limited period intervention to ensure the consequence management system works. The DG, through the Office of the DG, we've developed a circular to remind all our management that management and every person entrusted with resources is responsible for consequence management. So we wait on the next slide, really points out the capacity requirements of a consequence and ethics management unit that we've requested the DG to assist us with. So we won't spend too much of time on it. Just to dwell for a moment on the Public Audit Amendment Act, Chairperson, as the committee is aware that there have been changes to the Public Audit Act, and there's a definition of a material irregularity, which we are all familiar with, but ultimately what this means, it means one thing in the final analysis. It means that there's nothing new on the one hand. On the other hand, what is very new is that if the department does not take the appropriate steps to recover financial losses to the state, the individuals will have to account for it. So it forces us to implement the regulatory framework in the event of fruitless, irregular expenditure or other losses to the state or incidents against the public interest. We will have to take steps to correct and prevent and recover from it. If we don't, we'll be personally liable for the losses suffered. So the Public Audit Act means that our recommendations in the incidence of fraud and corruption will result in strict action against individuals under the definition of a material irregularity. So this act is also seeming to kind of empower the anti-corruption function in terms of recovery. So I think we're in for interesting times on how financial and material irregularities will be dealt with going forward. Chair, very important intervention that you're all aware of is that the business process review, that the absence of business processes results in incidents of mismanagement, that you don't have processes. So we have the IDMS, which is the Infrastructure Delivery Management System, and business process review projects currently in place. In our property business, we've been informed that we have the new process, the 2B situation, implemented on the 1st of April of the current year in the new cycle, so that our business processes ensure that we have order in the organization. Moving over from business processes, I just want to talk about the implementation of the Archibus system. Again, if one has no proper technology in IT systems, then the environment is again conducive to mismanagement, fraud and corruption. So the business processes and the IT systems are critical enablers of clean governance. And we've had these two projects in the implementation stage for far too long, and they are now coming to a close, and we have a responsibility to ensure that the implementation of these systems ensures that we have a proper environment and we have good governance to reduce our susceptibility to wrongdoing with manual systems, and the absence of processes create conditions for fraud and corruption. And the minister in this regard has pronounced and instructed that relevant branches to be ready with our ICT system by July 2020. So the department works towards that. Moving on from there, this is the system. We're moving on to the SIU, Chairperson and members of the committee. The SIU has had a number of proclamations over the years. And these proclamations are as follows. There are five proclamations. We initially had Article 38 of 2010, several years back, with the original proclamation of 2010, but in more recent times, Chairperson, we've had the lease portfolio, the R49 of 2014, which we'll talk about, and number four, we've also had the prestige houses portfolio in the Western Cape, and at the moment, we have a new proclamation dealing with emergency or day. The next slide just demonstrates the work of the SIU. It's very loaded in favor of the leases, because the SIU investigated in total 2,162 leases, which means they investigated every lease signed by the department with the private sector. And in total, then the SIU has 2,325 investigations. And similar to the department, the SIU then made recommendations for disciplinary action. There were 79 in total, and these are the outcomes of the disciplinary action. That 8 resignations and retirements, 3 verbal warnings, 14 written warnings, 20 final written warnings, and final written warning and suspension without pay, there were 15, and 10 of their cases were ended with the department unable to prove the misconduct, inadequate evidence, and 8 were finalized that they were dismissed. It was not a dismissal, it was dismissed by the chairperson due to inadequate evidence as well. And one person was found at the end of the process not guilty. That's a 79 in total. But the next section I go to, chairperson, you have on the next slide, is it says civil action there on the left side. Now, Chair, the civil action has been very helpful to the department. This is the core business of the SIU. They are into civil action. They recover losses for the state. And what has happened, you can see right through the slide, we have recoveries, or potential recoveries, and I move to the next slide with the totals there. And it shows that with the first proclamation, 685 million in 15 matters. Proclamation R59 of 2013, that's in Nkandla. One recovery of 155 million, leases 453 million, and prestige proclamation in the Western Cape 5.7 million to lead to a total recovery of 1.3 billion rand in 193 matters. The chairperson, some of these recoveries are dependent on the court outcomes. So they must go to court, and some of them are being recovered by the department itself. You see the 129 million in the third column from the right. It says 129 million in 41 matters. That was actually recovered by the department. That's landlords who were found to have charged us for space they did not lease to us, and also rates per square meter which were in excess of the lease agreement. The department then deducts it from the landlord's rental, where they sold the landlord. That's 129 million that has been valuable. Other matters are in court, so it will take time. And one of the positive developments we have is that the SIU have now established what they call a tribunal, which is their own court. It's their own court, and the judges have been appointed by the president, and that court will now hear matters to recover where the SIU has investigated. So they have their own court, and that will likely speed things up in future to ensure that we have court dates. At the moment, the SIU is bogged down in court because of the backlog in the court rolls. So this SIU is 1.3 billion in potential recoveries going forward. Some of them are very likely to be recovered, others less likely would, but it's dependent on the court outcomes. Then we have criminal action, chairperson. You can see the criminal action, the categories is the NPA has withdrawn 17 matters. There are 17 sitting with the NPA for this decision, or 29 at least. The 17 refer to the SARS, 5 are under investigation by the SEPs, and there are 4 matters before court that give you 72 referrals for criminal processing, and only 4 are before court. So we have communicated with the SIU to complain about this, and the SIU are working with us. I think the SIU are also working with the SEPs and the NPA to ensure that they get better service there. There is concern that matters are getting bogged down, the criminal matters in the SEPs, as well as getting bogged down in the NPA, and we hope to see positive developments going forward. So that's the overall view of the SIU, and there have been some systemic recommendations, chairperson. When you look at the prestige portfolio, the SIU found there's no proper record keeping in our prestige projects, there's a circumvention of procurement processes, that principal agents conducted procurement on behalf of the department. We abdicate our responsibility to third parties. That quantity surveys are not keeping proper records. That consultants were merely reappointed and we don't follow procurement processes. And in fact, in the final analysis, we don't oversee and manage our projects properly. And we found higher levels of negligence there. And then moving over to the lease proclamation. This is the 2000 lease investigation.
And what has transpired here is that landlords are submitting fraudulent tax certificates, and the department is paying for more space that is what actually available in the building. So we hire 5,000 square meter building, but there's only 4,000 in there, and we don't check it. We just sign the lease and we move in. And those are serious losses to the state. And there's also, we pay more for parking bays, they give us 10 parking bays and charge us for 100. So there also seems to be a level of collusion with our staff. The buildings are also in an unsatisfactory condition that transgresses the provisions of occupational health and safety, that we pay more than is due to landlords through rates per square meter, and we are also making duplicate payments to landlords, and then leases are continually renewed without testing the market. And this is a serious indictment on our leasing processes, that we don't follow Section 217 of the Constitution, that we've not been able to do that during our time there, that we extend leases with the same landlords through treasury dispensations, that we've not gone out and followed a competitive process. And that is another finding of the SIU, and it's also currently a problem for the department. Moving on from there, with respect to the SIU chairperson, they find that our day-to-day maintenance processes are increasing at an astronomical rate, which means that every maintenance is an emergency. In fact, if I just summarize all of this, what they're saying is that we're spending 60% of our maintenance budget on emergencies and only 40% on planned maintenance to put our building in the correct state. And we have some contractors appear on the list of preferred suppliers. They have links with other suppliers, so there's collusive bidding and collusive tendering. Some of our employees have interest in the businesses, and then document management is very poor. So that's some of the things and the concerns picked up by the SIU. And I will go past there, and I'll talk about now the unscheduled maintenance problem that the department is bedeviled with. Chairperson, the department, the anti-corruption unit, together with the SIU, conducted a detection review on day-to-day maintenance using technology in our databases and identified a number of red flags. We looked at the logo system, which is owned by Treasury. We looked at PMIS, which is our system, and also WCS, which manages our contracts. And we wrote a number of queries to identify red flags. And I move on from there and explain to you, this is what we see, that over a 10-year period, you can see where the maintenance trends are, that we spent most of our money in Pretoria and second in Cape Town and then Durban. But of more concern is perhaps this slide here, that you have some companies that are dominating the space. That you have a company, for example, their names are here. These companies, they probably do about 8 to 10 maintenance jobs a day for the department, and you begin to see that there are disturbing trends in how we award work. And when you look further into the trends, you would see that there are certain buildings which are utilizing all the maintenance budget. That you have the Department of Defense building using 300 million rand, so the average of 30 million rand a year. And in recent times, the same building is using an average of 50 million a year. And that's only unplanned maintenance. So a number of red flags were identified. Here you have red flags of duplicate payments. You can see some of the payments have the same numbers on the same day or a small period in between. So what has transpired, you can see, Chair, look at the frequency that the company in number one place has got 16,973 payments over a 10-year period. That's basically $1,700 payments a year. So what does it work out to per day? So there's something really unusual here. And if you go deeper into it, the same trend plays out in Pretoria and some of the other regions, but mainly Cape Town and Pretoria. If you go further, there are certain control weaknesses identified, that in our department we have a lack of verification of serviceable items like diesels, boilers and air conditioners. And there's a non-existence of a maintenance plan, and there's no reflection and no register reflecting building components. Ultimately, we don't even know things exist. It seems that in many instances you're dealing with fictitious calls from client departments. It goes through our call center to a person who is known, and they appoint somebody on Friday to fix a non-existent component on the weekend, and they pay it on Monday, and then they share the revenue. So there's a big risk of this identified, of this collusion between the various elements in emergency maintenance. So all of this, Chairperson, what happened in the Pretoria office, there were some instances, and I'll just show you the pictures. We have already investigated these, where we were paying for swimming pools and for the employment of family members, and this is what we get out of it. Yeah, we pay 7,000 a month to maintain the swimming pool, and the one swimming pool, it looks like it on the left. The other garden we maintain is in the middle slide, and then the other pool is already covered in grass and sand, but we maintain the pool for between 7,000 and 10,000 a month. So, Chairperson, all of these things gave rise to our engagement of the SIU, and then through the DG and the minister, a motivation was made to the president to sign a new proclamation called the Day-to-Day Maintenance Proclamation. And the focus of the proclamation is in what they call Proclamation Number R20 of 2018, and it focuses on the Pretoria, Bloemfontein, Cape Town, Durban, and Johannesburg regional offices. So what is happening is that the SIU have already made recommendations to the department to begin to deal with some of the control weaknesses, but this particular job is in progress. It's the only one proclamation of the SIU is operational, and it's the day-to-day maintenance proclamation. And the results, hopefully, we'll see over a period of time. So the anti-corruption unit also conducted a maintenance investigation, and to share with the committee, at our Johannesburg regional office, there's a tendency to award a contract for X amount and then to pay 2X for it due to clear project mismanagement. As you can see on the left, the contract amount and the payment. And then we cancel the contract because all these suppliers don't deliver the outputs. We issue it to the cheapest supplier normally, and then they don't deliver it. And you have the amount on the left reflects the contract amount and what was paid out when the contract was cancelled. And then we then issue the same contract to another contractor, often by an amount exceeding the initial contract amount. And what we found is that we have project risk management that is conducted prior to the award is disregarded. That you simply can't award a contract to anybody without considering the risk assessment, and it is disregarded. That during the phase of the contract, there's poor project management, and payments are made that are simply not justifiable compared to the project milestones. And the projects are simply not completed on time within their time frame, and that contractors are not delivering on their obligations. So there's a high level of negligence in the department in dealing with this particular project and how we manage it. And as a consequence, we've had disciplinary action against 42 officials from Johannesburg alone, and 8 contractors were submitted for restriction on the treasury database of suppliers, and then we're looking to recover losses in of 27 million, but that probably is far lower than what we lost, and we also referred contractors to professional bodies. So with other misconduct cases, Chairperson, we've also had these procurement irregularities, and this is an example of the CNEX prison, where we awarded a contract for 100 million and we paid out 90 million to the service provider. And then we fired the service provider. And then we appointed another service provider for 167 million. These show the same tendencies of the level of negligence in the department and the lack of consequence management. And it means that our line functions need to take action against the individuals, and we shouldn't be dealing with consequence management only when the anti-corruption unit then uncovers an allegation. So we need to deal with this from a management point of view. And we had similar tendencies at the Zealous police station and that run through the Mabato regional office as well. So what this shows is, Chairperson, that we need to show a higher level of diligence on the part of management. That it's not the anti-corruption unit that should prevent, detect, and protect the department from fraudulent practices, but management need to deal with it on a day-to-day basis. So Chair, in concluding, what I want to say is that the Ministers of Public Works and Infrastructure since 2018 have regularly engaged the media on the successes and also Parliament on the successes of the Department and the SIU in fighting fraud and corruption. We've also commemorated National Anti-Corruption Day annually in December. It's every December, and we commemorate it in the Department and remind our staff that corruption is not for us. Because we're highly vulnerable to corruption. It's simply too overwhelming. We find service providers calling us on a daily basis that they have orders from the department, and those are fraudulent orders, and they're dealing with criminals who are seeking taking bribes from them for awaiting award of this contract. And it would appear because the criminals are colluding with our own FCM staff to do these things. And what you have is that we need to respond to the ethical dilemmas in the department, and that is why we have this integrity management framework. And we're also collaborating very heavily with the JCPS cluster. We addressed the JCPS cluster of directors general last year to show them what we're doing with fraud and corruption and how they can help us. Given the fact that we're doing our part as a department and we need them to also speed up the investigation, and we're improving our collaboration with them. And also we need better consequence management in the department to serve as a deterrent, because what happens is it's worth the chance. The rewards are great, but the chances of getting caught and being disciplined are low. So we need to deal with consequence management more effectively. And then, we've introduced now fraud risk management, and that's our preeminent component of the anti-corruption strategy. We're placing more emphasis on fraud prevention through our fraud risk management process. We're also using data analytics to highlight fraudulent behavior in the department. We're introducing the consequence management unit, and we are also now demanding that fraud risk management becomes a management responsibility that goes into the performance agreement of all managers. And we also play an active role through governance structures. We have a risk management committee and an accountability management committee to review all of this, and we've also developed closer relations with the SIU and the Hawks in particular to assist us in investigation and prosecution of commercial crime in the department. So that's where we are, Chairperson. I thank you.
But it does happen. I think I mentioned before there was somebody found guilty
of massive fraud and corruption. She resigned before she could be charged and is now a Director General in the Eastern Cape in one of the departments. So we can't allow that to happen. So to me, there should be a register kept. Also, if somebody resigns or is dismissed before the finalisation of the process, does that process stop there? Or do you finalise that process to ascertain whether or not there was guilt? And if that is the case, it should actually happen that we should finalise the process even if somebody's been dismissed, so that at least we have on record that person, you know, that the allegations were well founded. And then slide 58 the internal weaknesses. This refers back to what I raised yesterday in our meeting, and for those who weren't there, when we were given our houses as members of parliament, there was no handover done with us. So we weren't taken through, you know, normally when you lease a property, the landlord takes you through, you go through, you look at defects, you make a note of what the problems are, so that you've got a baseline for when the person leaves. And you can then ascertain exactly what damage has been done in that intervening period. This isn't even being done with MPs on houses in our parliamentary villages. So it's obviously not being done at any level. With respect to taking over properties, and that's why we're opening ourselves up to this kind of fraudulent activity. So I think something needs to be done with respect to handovers. And the same goes, the other thing I wanted to ask you is, I did oversight in Durban at Excelsior Court recently. Now this is a building owned by Public Works. It's ostensibly leased to the Department of State. It was supposed to have been vacated in 2009 for renovation. That failed to evict everybody. So people carried on. There were apparently three policemen who refused to do this at the time. 5 years later, they were still trying to evict these people. When I went there last week, 120 flats are now fully occupied. My question is who's paying rent and to whom? This department will be liable for rates and taxes, etc., on that building, but are we getting any revenue on that? So are we monitoring the buildings that we own, where we've got lease agreements with private departments? Who's getting that money? Because according to the policeman I spoke to, his housing allowance is being deducted every month, but he's actually living there unofficially. So that's another thing that needs to be looked at, where we have squatters or we have people who are living in our buildings illegally, but we're still liable for rates and taxes on those buildings. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I'm overwhelmed by the information that we hear today. I think it's one of the honest presentations that we ever had about the department. Because I always believe that in life, we can always resolve things if we are honest about the problem that we are facing. But today, what is revealed today, though it's so sad, it's a sad story, but it also gives me hope that because we are open about what is happening, so which means we can take the right decision. And I still also I still say that not everyone within this department is bad. There are still good men and women who are willing to shape within this department. We get somewhere, but the consequence management really must happen. I know people think that the wheel of justice also is going slowly, but I think we can get somewhere. It's also said that we only receive the information very late, and Chair, with the information that is before us, maybe the SIU should have been presented aside, because that's where most of the information it is. But my question is, I just wanted to find out with the scope of SIU that they are doing with the department, and with the presentation is also evidence to that. I want to know how much is costing the department, or how much it has cost the department since 2013 to date in terms of the job that they are doing, because they are really doing what they're supposed to be doing. According to slide 22, you only mentioned about the suspension, people who have been suspended, without payment, but you don't tell us about 21 of them. You don't tell us about those that have been suspended with payment, if maybe you can tell us how many of those that have been suspended with payment, because many within government departments, many people have been suspended with pay. They stay about many years at home earning their salary before any disciplinary action can be taken. According to slide 14, I can see here the department in terms of fraud risk management plan. It's written 2016 to 2017. I want to also cover the date where we are now. It's clear that the department, they are doing a vetting process for hiring. But I want to find out, since this fraud risk management has been in place, how many people that we have detected and that they are not suitable to work for them, because you do the vetting before you hire them. So how many that you detected that these are not suitable candidates to work for the department? Or later, when you have employed them, there is a mistake on. So you realize these are the people, how many of them, and what have you done about it? I can also see that in terms of your fraud detection measures, you are also having the hotline. But it should be good if maybe you explain how many cases have been reported, because I found this hotline at some stage it was also not working. How often do you check that hotline? Is it really working so that you can see whether it is effective? Because sometimes we have a situation where people, they don't want to come open in terms of reporting fraud and corruption, because we know that if the whistleblowers, they also risk their lives to do so. I would also appreciate if maybe you can give us a breakdown in terms of your investigation, the statistical overview, in terms of the cases that are here, if maybe you can break them down within certain departments, so many cases is within our entities and whatever, so that we understand. Because according to slide 22, we just have so many dismissals. We want to know to the department which area these people were being dismissed. If maybe you can have that. Yes. And I think that is all, Chair. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I am prepared to say few questions. No, it's just a bit more time. On slide, let me just start slide 22. Let's start with slide 29 and slide 6. I'm leaving it because the part of what I wanted to raise has been raised already. So let's start with slide 29. How far are you with that process that the minister pronounced? The very same question stands on slide 6. Chair, I'm raising this because probably it's also not for the first time that I bring such a matter. It sounds inappropriate, DG, that you will come to us and say to us a submission was made to the Director General. To us, tell us what you have done. If you are sad, you can't tell us about, somebody can tell us about the submission made to you. So you come to us and tell us what you have done. Even if you do not have resources to say, the department will deal with it. But to be too general and tell us about submission. So my question is, how far is this process? Because really, you are bringing questions which are not necessary. Slide 36, a similar issue. In terms of the program, you have your own due date, 23 February, we don't know what is the progress, 24, 1 March, that one we can pardon, but we are on the eve of the 15th of March. And I don't want to believe that when you say it is a due date, you mean that you want to do that particular task on that particular date. So we'll believe that in the future, when you come to us, give us a proper. If you have not achieved what you wanted to achieve on the 23rd of February, speak to us, it's not done. And I to leave it naked like that. When you go to go today, I'm hungry, I'll not go. I'll not deal with all of them. Let's go to slide 70. When was this process concluded? I see Mr. Bakwena was sanctioned. When was this concluded? You are saying that your internal legal unit currently in the process of recovering these losses. How far are we with that particular process? So when was this concluded? How far are we with this recovery? I am both on probably a comment both on 1771 for us who are interested. I want to propose that when you put this figure, try to put them in ways so that you know that thousand, million, billion. We struggled with our bit of interest to get in there. Please put a bracket and say this is 1.5 million or this is 1.5 billion so that you balloon it well, big and shrink it when it's small. Chair, I think with that, Matebula will take over.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much. Well, few questions on my part. Well, number one, I see from the presentation you are talking about 50 grand, that gets to be, taken away through corruption. But again, I see that you here just an overview amount of money that you are talking about that happens in department, general income. Now, can you assist us to give us an overview of what is happening in the department, in the department, public works? Through fraud and corruption, we are losing 5 billion rand or 1 billion. Because this kind of statement by somebody was willing to do his or her work. By the way, I should say he is because he is here, as we have only met. Well, the other matter is in relation to issue of corruption again. I hear that you've got a police that says that you have whistleblowers who get to be protected. But I want to check also if there's any reward for any whistleblowers, because that if you've got a reward that helps to activate people quickly and faster, and also they become even more, alert when it comes to issues you think that it's time that you consider having put that into such a clause in your documents? Then the other thing, you spoke again about the issue of corruption. Well, I'm not so sure. Chief amongst the cases that you have mentioned, last week you said that the municipality that claimed for about 90 million or more, I can't remember the amount, that's what the minister said in passing. And then when, upon your investigation, you discovered that the money that you were supposed to pay, it was only 6 million. So now, of the cases that you are dealing with, referring them to SIU and so on and the police, is that case included? Because, as we said last week, that such an act of criminality, and it must be prosecuted in accordance to the law. Because I cannot understand that people can, you know, sign up to negotiate and say that this is what you are owing us. Because we have also mentioned quite a number of overstatements of amounts of monies that were paid in conducted the investigations and discovered that it is not so. Now, my last question or my last comment, I'm afraid so, is in relation to the issues of okay, let me deal with the issue of Uganda. I know that it's a matter of interest to the nation and the world. That how much have you recovered, and if you can also be able to give us if there is any prosecution and recovery of money. Or attachment of assets in that area. Well, you say also the SIUs, you've got cases that are before the courts. Now the SIU is going to like complain about the slow pace that these cases are taking in terms of them being dealt with. Now, you've got cases that have lasted for some months or years, but from your report, you can't indicate, or there's no indication or any signal that says so-and-so was found guilty and was sentenced to 15 years or 5 years or so. All what we are seeing is that you've got cases that are actually pending that are before, you know, the court, and then you are still going to, I don't know why do you want to do it now, because this is something that you should have done some time ago. And my view is that as a department, you need to be briefed from time to time about the progress of those cases that are actually making. Perhaps it might happen that maybe the fault or you are making the work of the prosecutors or of the investigators to identify that, because you brought up cases that are weak or cases that do not have enough information. But if you are sitting and complaining to us that it's good that you need to give us that information, but we need to see action on that to say that we have interacted. This is a report that we are getting, of course, without you going into details, because meetings like this, public meetings, you may not know who is here. But at least give us a little bit of a picture as to what exactly is it. But the way it is now, for me, I think it's a bit shallow, if I may say that. Well, you say the SIU, they are also indicated that the SIU, the court, they are copies. Well, my understanding is that civil matters are the most difficult thing in a law when you deal with cases. It's the most difficult one to deal with. But from your report, I can see and I can make an understanding that you, the answer is doing very well. But don't you think that it's time that you perhaps change the manner in which you report your cases? Perhaps you take them straight and direct to the police. Because from what I can get from your report is that SIU much as that in cases of criminality, but their work of specialists is on civil matters. I'm of the view that you should perhaps look at maybe taking it direct to the police, because I know for the fact that the police can move faster and quicker. And you must as well remember that the manpower, as it was reported at some point of the SIU, is a big challenge. So now if you are going to give them all of these cases, when you've got an alternative, then it becomes a problem. But very fast, Ms. Chair, with all the fraud and corruption and dismissals and, you know, warnings and everything that you have reported here, about. I just want to check from senior officials who of those that have been dismissed. Because in most of dismissed or given a warning or suspended or was retired because of, you know, cases of fraud and corruption. Because in most of the cases, what one has witnessed is that people who take a fall normally are the junior staff members. When you have a situation wherein where there is a tender or there is a payment, overpayment of a contractor, there is a signature of a senior official, but that senior official doesn't you know, suffer any consequences. I'll tell you, when you there's what they call it in preparation clause, your conveyancer would sign on a preparation clause. By so signing, the conveyancer is accepting the correctness of the information. Now what I'm trying to say is that when you are in senior official, you sign a particular payment to be made to a particular contractor, and then it is discovered that that particular contractor has been overpaid. So in our view, or in my view, is that you signed for that information, you signed that to indicate that the information that is contained in that document is correct. Now, if it is discovered that the information is not correct, why are you not taking the responsibility? Why are you not taken to trust? Because I can safely say that chief amongst the people who are here are people who are signing for such things, and nothing happens to you. So I think we need to report who of those that who are actually involved, who are senior members in signing for such, and want to know why actions are not taken against the senior officials. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I take a cue from one of my colleagues who commented about the transparency. But for me, the transparency doesn't mean a thing if you don't have a concrete turnaround strategy and consequent management in place. I think with all those, it gives hope that we'll see the improvement moving forward into the future. But I realize that before we were in 10 years in government, there were signs that somewhere there was an indication of corruption. For me, Chairperson, it's really overwhelming when our public sector does not appreciate where we come from, does not appreciate the expectations of our people on the ground. That's why I want to say, maybe we need from time to time not to lose the sight that we have priorities here. When we have priorities around unemployment and poverty, where are we when we face such challenges? I am aware of the fraudulent quotations that are being requested from the individuals that are sent through the individual companies. I think those people have the access to the national database. But safe to say that we have become aware that instead of the gov, the ZA, in between there is a dash, a small thing that you will not even be aware. But some other people have fallen victims into that. I think that needs also to fall within your advocacy program. But I'm not sure when you talk about advocacy, problem. Do you involve those people that have in the past raised disputes? I'm asking this because there is a company that seems to have had the monopoly of having too much work and benefiting against the whole lot that may have not even seen the lack of having the job. Please tell us about the disputes. What do you do when there are disputes around any tender that has been awarded? Because I would imagine, not unless the advocacy is not so strong, your communication strategy is not so strong to make people, because people outside can drive against any weakness or any fraud. But if we don't reach out to them to say raise your voice if they are such things that happen. I know for a fact that there is a burning issue around the province of KwaZulu-Natal, the issue of nutrition. It's been to court and solved in court, and I'm just wondering to myself, why are the contractors quiet when there is someone who's got the monopoly of the budget of the department? I am also worried about the mention of Eben, the province where I come from. That is, it's also mentioned to be also infested with a high corruption. I am not sure what to make out of it, but maybe one needs to go home and sleep and think. But those chapters are the regions that maybe we may need to visit, but also speak to those that are outside of the mainstream of the economy. Because those are the people that will tell us that this is how we lose out and being left on the cold. These are these so-and-so who monopolize in this region. I think those are the things that we need to follow up and also make a problem around this. The issue of the expenditure, and I could see that number one, that benefited most of the budget in terms of the construction is Gauteng, followed by Cape Town, my goodness. Then the third is KZN. And I don't know where is the Eastern Cape. The one is because, according to the stats, SA, and your poverty pockets, and the rural side of the majority. For me, this is really skewed, because I know the population of Gauteng, but it's not that Gauteng has so much of the rural masses that it's where it gets much of poverty. I would imagine areas like Yongsinga that is in KZN, we imagine the areas around the Eastern Cape. I'm not sure. It's so skewed, the way the expenditure pattern goes. Chairperson, the issue of the, I would like also to learn more about the benefit of the Ajima. And I would really want to know, so that we don't, from time to time, we are told that there are still challenges that would have been mitigated by the introduction of Ajima. I don't know around the issue of the Termini and the issue of EPWP. I'm trying to remember, or maybe you can remind me, or whether this is the issue around the safer cities in Termini municipality. I can't remember, but I think I remember there was something around that. But what are the consequences, and where are we with the investigation, and whoever that was found guilty, or are there, were there any court cases around that? Safe to say that, Chairperson, I remember that when we went to Pretoria, one thing that one noticed was the issue of staffing in your legal department. I think I saw one or two people that were there, if I'm not mistaken. But for me, it was a matter of, it looked like a skeleton that is not fully fledged. I'm not sure whether the other people were not there in the office, because one is not looking at the organogram as we speak. Maybe that is another issue for the future, because one of the things that one has noticed in my previous life is that you have a legal department. I'm not saying it's the same story with the department, but what one would have noticed in the past was that you have a department with a very weak staffing of the legal department, where whenever there are court cases, you always lose those cases. How many have you settlement have you had out of court vis-a-vis what you have approached the court in order to do? I know for a fact that some of the departments will even go to the extent of outsourcing the legal matter. For me, I would have thought, or I would have suggested, if that would be the case, is it not better to have a very strong legal component within, so that you don't chop and change the legal facts that some of them are known to be losing cases? If that is the matter with the department, maybe you remind me of what we saw when we give the oversight in the offices. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to welcome the presentation that we made and indicate that I am also discovered. Chair, I have a concern to start with. When I look at our agenda item, referring to details and forms by the DWI and the Ministry of Consequent Management regarding fraud and corruption cases. That's our agenda item. So I value all the information that has been shared with us, but little is being spoken regarding our main objective of this meeting. Then, Chair, I have a, when you look at slide 4, when you talk about the review of 500 billion, then the last point, bullet point is raising the issue of difficulty of balancing transformation, for getting work of the right quality at the best price on time. And I want to pause on the issue of the right quality. And I want to ask the department, how are you ensuring the quality control takes place in all your projects? Because I can at least mention one thing, and I think each of us can mention something where with the limited knowledge and expertise we have in certain fields, we'll see that some of the work that we've done is really of poor quality. And when you look at the numbers being spent, you just wonder if all this money has been spent, and when you look at the quality of the work on the ground, it's not paying up. So, Chair, when I look from slide 51, it's talking about unscheduled maintenance and the different subcategories. And you are detailing all the facts in that regard, maybe back 10 years. And it's just a great point of concern to me, seeing that since I have joined the committee, one of the main concerns was always the complaint in terms of maintenance being done. And now we see all this money that's being spent on unscheduled maintenance. So in actual fact, money is not the problem. It's how it's being spent. And we really need to zoom into this issue before it's going to blow up into our faces, because this, I think, is a breeding ground for maladministration and corruption. So we need to know how you are going to be moving forward, how you are going to remedy the situation. And with remedying the situation, I'm not talking only about a tick box exercise, but we need to see a real action plan. Because clearly you've identified the areas of concern, you've identified possible culprits, that now action needs to take place, and we need to see that action finding expression in our, as from our first quarterly report of the next financial year. Then, Chair, when we look at the different categories of investigation, on slide 21. I'm not sure, Chair. I need just guidance from the department in directing me where we can locate the issues of state funerals and state events. Because surely I'm not talking about the methods in a race and scope. Unless you are telling me that's the only issue in terms of that area of concern, or in terms of that area that they are explaining. So in this regard, I I'm assuming, I would have assumed that at least one or two slides will have some background information or something in that regard. But I can't find it unless it is falling under another category. Then when we look at the anti-corruption guidelines, there's no step, unless I overlook it, there's no step in terms of the efficiency or the effectiveness of that guideline. Because surely some resources are being put in place to maintain that guideline, and we don't have any indication of how many cases, what kind of cases, the prospect of success, and we need some sense in that regard. I think I'll pause there, Chair. Thank you very much.
Within these 5 years, this lifespan, this finished.
and the site it must be replaced, because after that we're going to have to repair it each and every day. So to me, those recommendations, I think they must see its way whether they become policies of that particular management, facilities management and all that. So we don't find the department in this and find out that the government is wasting so much money that you'll find out that it has gone and maybe under the drain, if you can do that under the drain. Because when you have a contract that is cancelled and you find out that the same contractor has been paid more than half of the amount, but that contractor has been cancelled, you then look for another contractor to do the same job. You pay more money. So we really need to look at it. And there's really serious challenge in terms of Pretoria, Cape Town. Maybe it's because, I don't know, because I don't think it's the truth that the majority of the buildings are there. Maybe the major ones, not the majority, the major ones. In Cape Town, you have Parliament, in Pretoria, it's the head offices and the union buildings and all. But there is a lot there. I think also the department itself must pay closer attention to that. Honorable Mashon, I wanted to just to say just one thing before we head over to DM and DJ and DJ.
I wanted to use the short straw point. Chair, one issue. On the issue of variation, can you clarify out of, like, for instance, on slide 70, have you, do you know what goes to fruitless expenditure, what goes to irregular expenditure out of this variation? Have you able to make a determination? Thank you very much.
No.
I'm not saying anything.
There's something that came to my attention, that some companies, I'm just seeing the majority of the companies in terms of those actual maintenance is from Cape Town and Victoria. Some companies, apparently, it's a postcode thing. So which means even if the maintenance would take place in Northern Cape, that company's head office is in Western Cape. So automatically, that would fall under Cape Town. So can we have some kind of investigation in that regard also? So that we can pinpoint it to the place of service in the valley. Thank you.
DM, DG, and DDG. As it's clear that most of the things are happening in Cape Town and Pretoria, we'd really appreciate it as the committee if you could provide us with the support of the companies that have been doing maintenance within these two areas, Cape Town and Pretoria. I know that we don't have such a list here. Maybe in the period of 2014 up to 2019.
Thanks very much, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. I'll attend to some questions and my colleagues will take over and after the team round up. On the last one, yes, we'll prepare that report. The one on fruitless on variation orders, yes, we do have information with respect to which one falls within fruitless and which one are wasteful and so on. So I think we can actually also provide A spreadsheet of that report we do is already available, this one. On the issue of the issue of remedying the unplanned and scheduled maintenance, we will provide a report on this one, because already as a department we have taken a decision that this one risk area where we are going to put in place 10 contracts, and also we have identified the 300 buildings which we need to put facilities management companies to take care of the micro repair and maintenance in those buildings. We can provide a report on this one. We are aware that if we can do this, it will scale down this lot of money that we're spending on unscheduled maintenance. I also agree with the honorable members who are saying we don't lack money in the department. It's the main thing is more how we spend it. I always share with my colleagues that I don't think we need more money. We've got money now, which we're supposed to spend it correctly when we do our work. So this one will resolve a lot of problems. The term contracts already, we also advertise contracts for purposes of maintenance of leads. Because normally if we come up with the big tenders, only the big companies participate. But this one, with the discussions with the minister, there is a program wherein we said we target a particular threshold of companies so that they must come into the picture to do our repair and maintenance, but on a longer term, maybe 3 years or so, it's going to address a lot of problems, this one. On the issue of the legal department, my colleague is going to address this one with respect to how we are capacitated. The issue of what happens where there are disputes on tenders, I think this is an area where we have got a lot of issues also from time to time, because we are a heavily procurement driven department. There are a lot of disputes here, but our disputes, we resolve them through alternative dispute resolution. We come to agreement, and then those which we don't agree, they end up going to court, and then they take a long time to be resolved. The issue of categories of employees who go through consequence management, I think it's all categories. My colleague should give an indication. We have got chief directors, DDGs, directors who are found to receive warnings, suspensions. I think this one, it covers everyone. The issue of we do the verifications also, vetting of employees. We do have information with respect to those employees who do not pass the vetting process. We don't appoint them. I think my colleague there in corporate services can provide the details to the portfolio committee. We do have them. Those who don't pass the vetting process. And then it also gives us an opportunity, because vetting is multidimensional. It looks into the requirements of the position. It's also looking to criminal records. Where there are criminal records, obviously, we don't proceed. Where we find that we have appointed the base without having maybe verified certain things, because sometimes things slip through the process, we make those people aware, and then we process the matters to terminate the appointments. Yeah, the issue of government buildings which are occupied and then sometimes we don't receive the payments in terms of the lease agreement and so on. It's a matter that we're working on, this one. We have developed a project, particularly in the area of payment of rates and taxes, verification of occupancy as to whether the people who are occupied there is the people who are actually legitimate, who are supposed to pay the department. We're looking into this matter, but it's an area that I can't say now here that we are fully aware about everybody who's occupying the government building. There are areas where people might be occupying without the knowledge of the department. Even close to our headquarters there, we have got one building which is fully occupied by people who are not legitimately occupying those buildings. We're in a process of either regularizing or evicting them. So it's a process that we engage in. The issue of if someone resigns in the process of disciplinary processes, the government has got a dispensation wherein if you can move from one department to the other whilst you're facing discipline in another department, obviously that discipline will proceed. But there's also a legal position which I think, if it is pursued, because I take the comments from honorable members, that we need to consider that those who resign whilst they are undergoing discipline, they must be considered as having been dismissed. It's a legal question, this one, which I think is subject to contestations. Currently, the status is that if one resigns whilst undergoing discipline, we don't consider it as dismissal because we have not completed the process. It's a legal question. Because there's no longer employee-employer relationship. You can only dismiss the person who you are having control of in terms of employment. But I think it's a matter that can be taken further. Since it has been raised here, we'll look into it. And engage and find out in terms of case law as to how can it be applied going forward. We're taking it as a matter that we should. The issue of ethnic cleaning, I think, is a matter that we're looking at with our colleagues in EPWP. We'll provide a report. Yeah, we don't have an answer now, but we're looking into it. And then, I think I'll give to my colleagues to clarify on those other questions.
Thank you, DG. Chairperson, we have tried to avoid what the DG has already answered, and I'll supplement in some areas as well. With respect to DPWP, it was mentioned that we only have two cases. I'd just like to also point out that with respect to EPWP, the department is not the implementing agent, it's a coordinator of the program. So the fraud and corruption takes place at the implementing body. So we don't investigate the implementing bodies, we rarely do. That is why we have only a minimal number of cases where we ordinarily refer to the implementing agent or body. Moving on to dismissals, we had an example a few months ago when an employee resigned and went to SAT-SA. And it was just before Pali Leofla resigned, we wrote to Mr. Leofla and informed him about this matter, and we continued the investigation. And that person resigned from SAT-SA as well. We're still in the public service, and we are aware of it, we'll follow you, and we've done that successfully in the past. With respect to the SIU costs, we've spent between 400 and 500 million historically. That is what my memory indicates to me, this amount where we are. With respect to suspension without pay, we haven't had suspension with pay. We only have that where we're conducting an investigation and we believe you will interfere with the process of investigation and then put you on suspension with pay. But ordinarily we don't have that. Slide number 14, yes, it started out in 2016-17, but it's continuing and is still part of the journey we are embarking upon. With respect to vetting, the department vets senior officials. They all go through a vetting process on a regular interval, and when they're not suitable, they obviously don't receive a security clearance. And that means that they then are not suitable to occupy the particular position. This usually happens where a person is undergoing the clearance for the first time. But when they're already in employment, we haven't had incidents where they fail the clearance. It would be interesting to see how we dealt with that. I think that's something that's prevalent throughout government, even in the security services, that we are already in employment, they seem to pass the clearance. But if they didn't, it would be interesting to see how we dealt with them. With respect to SCM, there's a government policy that SCM officials must also be vetted. And we have a backlog there, due to the State Security Agency having their own backlog. So perhaps at this time, we've only vetted 40% of those officials. And that's obviously our high-risk area. It's clear that SCM officials, with some of them very junior, because we use interns in that area, they are obviously involved in a lot of malpractice and leaking of information to contractors. A vulnerable area. With respect to the fraud hotline and over the years is maintained, has been maintained by the Public Service Commission. So it's an independent anti-corruption hotline. And over the years it's declined in the quantum of referral we've received. We receive now about one every quarter, about 4 years. In the past it was more, perhaps double that, maybe sometimes one a month. But now it's declined to 4 years. With respect to the statistical breakdown, we'll refer back to the committee about which branches are involved with respect to those matters. With respect to CMEX prison, the investigation and how it was concluded, and the consequence management there, there were two questions. We've had a person given a suspension without pay, and also a demotion. And these are questions we need to ask ourselves from a consequence management point of view. The demotion and suspension without pay for the loss of like 150 million. This is a universal question we need to ask about the nature and the severity of the sanctions in the public service. That are they concomitant with the losses suffered by the state and the harm caused to the state? Could be building a clinic or hospital. And the losses suffered are not only financially in nature, but they can be quantified in other terms as well. And sometimes the sanctions are not what they ought to be, but that's what it has been under this particular case. To put the numbers in words, is that the loss of corruption to government, that loss of corruption was quantified by the CIDP. And in the department, we know what we spend. And it's impossible to actually say with conviction what it is. But we know that we are losing to fraud and corruption because there are gaps. We also know for a fact that when we conduct the investigation and one then another analyzes the behavior, that you often find that some of our employees see an opportunity when they see a project, a personal opportunity. So you have that, and the numbers could be anything. It could be 10, 15, 20%, 30% losses on every contract. When you also add up the fact that we don't deliver all the contracts within budget, those are further losses. When we dismiss contractors and appoint secondary contractors to finish the work, those are further losses. So we're losing up to 30%, and it's just an estimate, you know, that it's very subjective, that we are losing on contracts. With respect to rewards and whistleblowers, we've commenced the process with Treasury to talk about the reward system. And this commenced with respect to our Operation Bringback project, where we're investigating state properties that are illegally occupied and state properties that have been illegally transferred to third parties. And we're having great difficulty identifying those transferred to third parties. We have this, land is an emotive issue, and there have been allegations that a lot of land has been plundered pre and post 94, and we have very few leads in this area. In our department, we have about 15 to 20 different cases where property was in fact stolen and we are pursuing them to different avenues. But we need to know more, and a whistleblowing strategy seems to be the only methodology that will work. We've tried other methodologies like interrogation of the deed record and this kind, and it's very expensive looking for a needle in a haystack. So we believe that the whistleblowing strategy will work, but it must be accompanied by a reward system. And we are working with National Treasury to determine whether such a reward system, given the fact that the state will benefit through a return of more valuable properties. So we're engaging Treasury in this regard, and perhaps your recommendation from the committee extend that this kind of reward system to ordinary investigations where the state saves money. We could consider the reward system to well include it. The issue raised by the rate, the misrepresentation regarding the rates claim, we would follow up with the minister and determine whether it will fall within our particular mandate and how we can respond to it. With respect to Nkandla, the question was asked of us, and what transpired there is that something, and my information is 2 or 3% either way inaccurate, it's about 15 or 16 staff members were charged through disciplinary processes for not complying with procurement regulations in the department, and all of them were sanctioned in one way or another. I do recall, Chairperson, that we had retirements, we also had a death in that group before charges could be preferred, but with the number of individuals who were there at the time, the department then meted out several sanctions, which also include suspensions without pay and warnings. That is the maximum sanctions that was meted out. And with the other staff, the department then also reached some kind of plea agreement. So we went so far, and then the department reached plea agreements with all of them, and the suspensions were mostly of a mild nature and were concluded in that manner. That is the disciplinary processes. With respect to criminal processes, those are included in the SIU record of criminal referrals to the NPA. Several criminal referrals were made, and what transpired is that the SIU is in discussions with the NPA to assist them to bring them to court. That is the last we've heard about that. We also know that from a civil point of view, before the Pietermaritzburg High Court on the 10th of June last year, they appeared Mr. Makanya. He was the overall principal agent, department appointed to oversee the entire project. And the SIU pointed out that he was individually and severally responsible for losses incurred because of the inflation of the project beyond a security scope, and sought to recover it from him on the expectation that he'll join other subcontractors in. So the matter was postponed last year. It was supposed to be heard on the 10th of June last year at the Maritzburg High Court, and Mr. Makanya, he asked for a postponement because he was not prepared. The SIU appeared to have been over-prepared. I think we intimidated, and the judge then asked for the matter to be postponed to a date to be determined. He's still on a roll at the Maritzburg High Court. And we've been told that the SIU, their own tribunal, they're hoping that their own tribunal will be aid in September this year. So we hope to have that matter before court and to set some kind of precedence in that regard. The colleague also asked a question about criminal matters that are referred by the to the CEPS and the department, where it refers its cases to the SIU as well. And what I want to point out is that we refer matters directly to the CEPS, and the SIU also refers matters to the CEPS, but we are aware of all of them. We keep a track of them, and the feeling is that it also played out in the media last year, where the SIU just pointed out the SIU has a service level agreement with the National Director of Public Prosecutions. And the SIU pointed out that the National Director of Public Prosecution is not obeying the terms of the service level agreement, and the SIU became frustrated that there were cases were not coming to court. And we also raised the same matter with the National Director of Public Prosecution personally through a similar presentation of our information and our referrals. And the National Director asked us to bring all the cases to attention that the department referred, And we did that through the SIU. And the SIU also had engagements with the National Director of Public Prosecutions to bring matters to court. And we're hoping that matters will come to court and we will see the light of day and that we'll see improvements in the National Director of Public Prosecutions, the NDP, and the NPA as a whole. We've also engaged the Hawks. The colleague asked, what are we actually doing? That's not coming off. We've engaged the Hawks. General Khanna, they are responsible for commercial crime. We've been having discussions with them. And we've also had meetings with the NPA ourselves. So we've done many things, but we have not seen much change. And we believe that this year perhaps change will come because of the kind of pressure that's coming from very high up for commercial crime and for corruption in particular to be dealt with in the public service. And we're pushing very hard and we hope that the SIU tribunal will change things as well. So we're working very hard to bring matters to court. With respect to the question on the juniors and the seniors, we charge everybody. And I believe that we have some recent cases that are talking to senior individuals in the department. So the status of the individuals, they don't matter. And we've always had senior officials also being charged. And in recent times, we've had cases where that are still at the conclusion stages that talk to senior officials being held to account. With respect to the turnaround strategy, the ones in the consequence management that the member also raised, the issue of the cabinet approval, we want to say that we have this anti-corruption strategy that was initially had its genesis in the 2002 minimum anti-corruption capacity requirements sponsored by cabinet in 2002, and now we're following the 2018-2019 anti-corruption strategy. It means we are going to talk more openly about corruption. We're going to engage our contractors and our suppliers and civil society. We're going to take a holistic approach. We're holding our branch managers responsible because anti-corruption unit is a small unit. It cannot take on this responsibility on its own. In fact, it's already taking on more culpability than is warranted. So we're taking an all-encompassing approach going forward with the new national anti-corruption strategy. With respect to the response, ultimately, the member mentioned that the public servants don't understand public needs. And that is why we have the integrity management framework. It's a call to our members of staff to account for who we are and what we do and to understand our role and purpose as public servants. Ultimately, that's more important than any investigation. So that's where we go. With respect to fraudulent quotations and the advocacy program, we make announcements in the department and to our service providers. We receive calls from service providers saying to us, I have an order from you to deliver this, and we say, no, it cannot be from us. There's an increasing prevalence of different types of order scams. In the past, criminals were cloning our order forms and sending it to Company A. And Company A, we had Dell computers deliver 600 laptops to another venue, and the criminal seized it. So this is just one element. Now there's a new type of scam, that what they do is they our staff are leaking information to criminals. And they know, the criminals know who are the three shortlisted contractors. So the criminals contact these shortlisted contractors and say to them, I know you bid for this job. You're going to win it. But you know there's this DG and these DDGs, they like money. Come on. 150, 300,000, you're getting a 30 million contract. Let's do this for you. And they scam them. And then they believe they're going to win something and they call us. And they say, yeah, right, they've been scammed. So all of these things, we have advocacy programs and we inform the staff and the contractors about what's going on. The DG covered the tender disputes, and I want to say also we spoke about protecting the whistleblowers, and we have legislation to do that. But ultimately it's difficult being a whistleblower, because ultimately you will pay a price. That is the experience we have. But what about our anti-corruption unit investigators? They also face huge risks and animosity and that kind of thing, because they work obviously has a detrimental effect on staff members as well as contractors. We've had incidents before, we've even been threatened by contractors. So there are all sorts of things to bear in mind there, but this work is risky work. And then with respect to the focus on day-to-day maintenance, what I want to say is that the chairperson asked the question, we have in writing communicated all the recommendations to our facilities management unit. All of these things have been communicated to them, so they presented. And at the Expo of January, February this year, they presented us a response plan. So they do have a plan in place. Perhaps they can come to the committee at some point and demonstrate what they are doing to close the gaps. Because they don't have to wait for the SIU to report in 2 years' time. They can start their processes immediately. So that's what we're doing, the chairperson. With respect to the funerals, the colleague asked the question there, has been directed by the DG and the Deputy Minister there on how to cover that. Then with respect to CMAX, can we categorize a CMAX? Yes, we have our reports categorized specifically. This is irregular, it is fruitless. So our CFO receives it and follows the Treasury guideline on recovery of fruitless and also to categorize it in the financial statements accordingly. And then finally, with respect to the CMAX phenomenon, where we pay for services we don't receive, that again talks to the system. With CMAX, as I mentioned, we see the demotion and a suspension without pay. But it's probable that the individuals will do something again in the future. But this is what they do. And if you look at the history, then you can say it with a reasonable suspicion that this is how they go about their business. So unless there's a higher level of deterrence, it will probably continue. So we need to look at sanctions in the department and how we apply it as a deterrence going forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Just two issues. The legal unit. I think you touched on the legal unit, the strength of the legal unit and so on. The legal function is actually centralized because of legal implications, which may be huge for the department, but also the cost implications in the event that the case goes into millions and millions of amounts of rent. But the structure is such that each and every of the regional offices, which are actually offices that are an integral part of the national office, have a legal admin officer. Those are qualified attorneys that are admitted in court. But as you will know, the structure of government is that the legal function is an internal support function. All your legal cases that may result in court processes has to be referred in accordance with the State Attorneys Act to what we call the attorney of government. That office is the one that deals all litigation matters on behalf of government. And hence, the role of legal would be to prepare the cases, all the necessary information, but the process then gets taken forward by the Office of the State Attorney. In the department, we have challenges in two regions in particular. Devon is not one of them. It's the Mthatha region, where even up to now we don't have a legal admin officer there, and the Western Cape. The Western Cape has gone through a selection process. They are going to appoint, in fact they've recommended, they've got a recommendation for a legal officer. The Eastern Cape is still a challenge, so the work of the Eastern Cape is done by head office. So the chief director of the legal, together with his team, are the ones running all legal matters on behalf of Mthatha. That is insofar as the legal issues are concerned. The one other issue that was raised relates to the ERP system that we're using, I think the benefits of it. I think that was the question. Although we have not been able to conclude it up to this stage, but there's lots of progress. Firstly, the removal asset register, if you remember at some point, we spoke about it being on an Excel spreadsheet. I can tell you now, it is live on the system. All transactions, all changes, whether we acquire property, dispose of property, it happens on the system itself. The second other achievement that we've done up so far, it is the listing module, especially the finance side of the transaction. All transactions for the listing module are done on Outbase as we speak now. The biggest challenge, as you have noticed in the report, right on top, is the IDT corporate governance. I'm sure you've noticed that. And I think there's been several interventions by the DG, by the audit committee, and it seems things are turning for the best. Because for the first time we've had consistent steering committee meetings, representing all the major branches. Now the critical thing is that business has to lead in terms of driving the input, the data issues, the migration of those data, and the spread of their various areas. If they fail to participate, they frustrate the completion of the work that we completed. Like I have indicated, there seems to be promises because we had three committee meetings in the middle of the year, even one this past Tuesday, and there is tremendous progress in that respect. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me start with the suggestion or the question on resignation before I search. Because this is a matter we have elevated in political discussions as the government. We have engaged with the matter. In the government, because of the various experiences and observations that in fact what you are raising that is true, that a person will be charged, will drag the case when they know that they are guilty, they will drag, make every effort that the case takes a long time, frustrate the process. Once they realize that now all evidence has been led, the chairperson is busy with finalizing the case, and they know they're guilty, they will be found guilty, they resign. They don't go to another department, they merely resign. Stay home, take the retirement package, stay home for 6 months up to a year, busy applying to other areas, other departments, and will surface later then. And will still continue to do that which they were used to doing. In the previous law. So there is a legal lacuna, as Vichy was saying, that there's a point at which the relationship ends, which you then cannot take as the employer or the previous employer cannot take the case back because that relationship legally has ended. They avoid going to immediately to another government department because of the risk that you may fall into. So they stop completely the relationship with government so that that case can be a matter of the past, and they won't go to the same area that they had committed the act of fraud, corruption, whatever that they would do. So the Department of Public Service is trying to interrogate this system such that we are able to find a solution, because that principle of having a register not only for cases of fraud and corruption, actually, even on sexual harassment, the similar proposal has been made that he and she who has been dismissed for committing acts of sexual harassment must be on a register so that they are never employed back in the state. So there are those discussions, but the Department of Public Service is looking at those. The second point I would like to comment on is the handovers that are not properly done. It's a general problem, and it's a problem that also I see on the list of areas on the recommendation on how to deal with this. One area that is
there's no real focus on, which warrants that as we go back, we must then say, what do we do about handovers? Because for me, the risk is too huge. We've had stories, but they remain stories because you now cannot have evidence of people when a member who was residing in a government property left, they left certain items which belong to House A. When a new member comes in, those items are no longer the same. They would have been changed. And therefore, when that handover is missing, you really can't keep track of what was there. When did it go missing? And how did it go? You are right there. And I would want to implore on both the DG and the DDG to find a recommendation that speaks to that. The SIU cops, the question that was not really adequately responded to, and I can say that it goes into millions. And we were elected as the minister of the huge amount that was spent. And minister has engaged with the FIU to try and see what we could do and why the cost. So I do want to alert the honourable members that truly it goes into hundreds of millions because of the time they've taken the department, but also because of the time they have to spend in each and every case. The amounts are quite huge. I may not have them in my head now, but I can assure you they go into hundreds of millions. As per the last report that they alerted us about, and we have engaged with the FIU to enhance. Now they will be reporting of some steps that are seeking to direct and assist the FIU so that they don't spend a lot of time on one case. They are able to be given information internally which will assist them to finalize cases quicker. On the question of the issues of procurement, I normally say this, we have become a department of tenders. Whatever comes our way, there will be a tender for this. There will be a tender. We have stopped thinking about how can we provide this service without a tender. You will not find that in the department, which is a major challenge, which we are also working on, because there are areas where you seriously do not need a third party, because now you pay a company to do work of people in the institution who could simply manage a group of others internally to do the work and would cost less. We rarely do that due diligence in saying what should go out on tender and what is it that we can do on our own. That's a mindset shift that we must drive, which we are trying to engage in, in order to try. We have engaged the CIDP because we have realized the issue of inflation of cost is an issue that is quite a huge threat, which makes the department so vulnerable. I will just make a very simple example. A few weeks ago, we visited one member's house which had issues. Looked at the issues, and I realized, no, these are issues that you can quickly deal with. 2 weeks later, I received a memo to say, here are the issues that we found in this member's house, and this is what they will cost. And I can count the issues. I can count with my hands that they needed 2 floor rugs, they needed 1 bed, they needed blinds and curtains. And the memo that came in front of me was saying that would cost 360 something thousand. And I said, okay, it's fine. Please give me the data. And it doesn't come back.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't require rocket science to see that these figures for anything and everything gets inflated. And if I was then saying to the CIDP, you cannot keep quiet when that is happening, because in the building industry, that becomes that runs into billions money that the state could utilize to ensure employment of a number of people, because if the small cake we have could be utilized prudently, expeditiously, effectively, efficiently, we could be able to finish, say, a 1 million rand project at 1 million, and not find a 1 million rand project ending up in 20-30 years, because that's what's happening. These figures are inflated 10 times. Now you could have implemented programs and projects that could help us reduce unemployment and develop our country better. So the CIDP, Treasury, and the entities within the department and some units, we have ensured that they meet together so that they make an input in the review of the procurement process with specific focus on ensuring that we manage this risk. In that legislation, we ensure that their intention of ensuring that women, youth, participate in business with government, those principles get properly encompassed in that reviewed legislation, such that we are able to procure, to streamline the risk, or to do away with the huge risks that are currently in the procurement system. Remember that no politician is there. Even the fact that I happened to see the 300,000 it was because they had to say, where you've been, they had to give this report, where you've been, and what you saw, this is what it will cost, because they had to submit that report. Now, ordinarily, it's not important that we would see. They, as management, are the ones who manage those processes, and they are the ones who must ensure that those risks are mitigated. But we're driving them as part of oversight function to ensure that they respond to those challenges. The issue of, which was also not responded to, of the funerals and what function, that is the one issue in front of SCOPA as we speak. But the directorate prestige has been tasked to review, even for themselves, to review that the current method of implementing procurement, especially for funerals, working with the president. Because at times, some of the demands come from families. Some of the demands come from the presidency, or I may not say demands, what would, yes, some of the those items that would be needed. If the president is going to be there, we'll need 1, 2, 3 for security, for this, for that. We were then saying, let them also be part of that review of that policy, so that we minimize damage in this. Because also, this has its own sensitivities. Those families that would have lost their loved ones, it's not good that we, after the fact, find their surnames associated mm-hmm. with malpractice. Mm-hmm. So there is also that engagement that my then last point is maybe we also need to, as members, we also need to look at the effects ourselves first, but also the community to assist. Look at our own code of practice, because for me, the numbers of people found guilty in this act of fraud, corruption, ending up with suspension for 2 months. Those for me are too lenient. They don't go at the heart of dealing decisively with the act. And therefore the review of our own code of conduct and the national legislation that it's a matter that we need to also look at. Such that for these types of offences, where one is found guilty of fraud, corruption, sexual harassment, we seriously need to have very tough penalties for those kinds of actions. Those would be my
giving you only 20 seconds.
Thank you.
the book Shakespeare Justice Park was supposed to have been finished in 2016 and started construction in 2014, the 285 million rand project. The contractor went into voluntary business rescue in 2016 and was eventually exercised last year. They only reckon they will have somebody on the site by November. Can we get a report on that? Because there must be an additional cost implication with respect to the delays, etc. Expected, what, 4 years overdue. And I think that's similar to the sort of CMAX scenario. We've already done investigations in the public. There don't seem to be any reports on any of the issues around problems in KZN. So if we could get a follow-up on that, because I think that's also a project that requires some intervention. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Honourable Graham. We won't respond to now, because we had already taken the comments and the questions. Honourable Councillor, if you want to add something as well.
The review of national anti-corruption strategy, you mentioned consequences with Netflix versus in civil society in Glasgow. You are not referring to business, to labor in that. Anything just.
As I've indicated, you are not taking questions to respond now. It can be an intense response that we will share with the members. As the chance of giving to members to ask questions and comment. Again, I appreciate your presentation, but before I round up, I want to propose to the members, looking at the time now, and looking at that, we still have going to get another presentation which will help to interact with the time now, it's almost half past 12. That, because next week we're supposed to have one strategic planning, which the Parliament has asked us to postpone for a later date, that we take this presentation for next week. We're supposed to have our strategic planning next week, according to the program that we adopted as the government. But the Parliament has asked the committees not to hold their strategic planning next week. So I am proposing to the committee, do we agree on that one? So the termination of employment contract that has led to the incapacity of the department, we'll deal with them next week, DM. DG and division. We'll deal with that next week. Honourable members, DM, DG, division, the team. I think we all want the seriousness of the challenges raised in the report and also by the members when they were interacting with the report. And we also note that when it comes to Cape Town and Pretoria, there are material there in terms of what it is. The huge challenges that are facing these two areas, Cape Town and in Pretoria. We also note that you have a risk management policy or guidelines that you have set up as you are presenting to us. But I don't think that is enough. Because as you can see that after 10 years it has not stopped. After 3 years, much as though you have an anti-corruption strategy in place, but really there's nothing that you can say it is decreasing. Rather, the amounts are going up. So it means that you have to work hard to ensure that your anti-corruption strategy is just not in paper, or is just not for compliance, that you must have the strategy in place. It must be utilized to achieve the results that you want. I think as you have indicated so, even in the presentation, that the president, when he came in 2018, and even last year after the elections when he came in, he has always hammered on the issue of an anti-fraud and anti-corrupt South Africa that we all desire. So it means that your anti-corruption strategy should work there. It should not be just something that is there. It means, therefore, where we see weaknesses, we need to tighten up. And the reality is that you can see the weaknesses as we are presenting the report to us. That you need to tighten up. We have identified that the supply chain management is one of the weaknesses. We have identified also that the maintenance is also one of the weaknesses. Then you need to come up with strategies. How do you tighten up? In fact, even if you can see with ADM on the number of cases that has been reported here, if you look on those lines, when it comes to tender, it's very few. I was looking at the numbers that were given. When you come to tender processes, very few cases there. But in other issues, many cases. Look at the slides that were given to us. And I was saying, like, exactly what is happening. But you can see again and over again, always, those that are in finance, they have a way. You will say, this is the strategy to prevent this. They have a way of going around that strategy. They have a way of going around that strategy that you have put in that. No, if we do things like this, there won't be any fraud in this. They have a way of getting around the bush on the issue. What it means is that it means you need to tighten up where there are weaknesses. You also need to ensure in Joba your anti-corruption strategy is a working document, not just there, because it is required that you must have an anti-corruption strategy. In those few members, we will always have, is it a home flight? Is this a wrong code? You know, whatever that is being done. There's a lot of budget, and with the added responsibility of infrastructure, definitely these cases that we have mentioned, they're going to spike up. You have an added responsibility of infrastructure now for the Department of Public Health. A lot of money is going to be channeled to this department to ensure that services are delivered to our people. So if those services are not delivered and the money has gone in another side, people of South Africa, spouse, leaders are not getting it. Where is this money? We have said there's money. DGS said there's money in public health. But the money is not going to the right place. It's going to the individuals who own companies, who don't do the work that they are supposed to do. It means that we have to stand up. We need to be on our toes. We need to ensure that services are delivered. If a court has to be built, the court must be built. If a school has to be built, the school must be built. It cannot be the case that a court which was supposed to be built in 2 years, it is 6 years now. That court has not been built. but the amount that was supposed to be utilized has doubled or sometimes has tripled due to this corruption tendency. Members, we really appreciate your contribution. We have requested, as I indicated earlier, that we need the number of contractors, especially doing maintenance work in Cape Town and Victoria. We need to check something else because it is clear that you swear a lot of things are happening. We need the right within this, we look at it as the committee, maybe next year. But one other thing is that next week, Wednesday, we will be dealing with the second item that is supposed to be today. We already have the documents. We want to ask for the issue of the document next week. Next week.
But when we're speaking about the list of the list of companies, can you also be provided with the names of the owners of those companies? Because that is also crucial. Because there are people who use different names of different companies for committing purposes.
Members, I don't think we need to go to that. When you know the company, you can even check yourself, remember, who are the directors of that company. That information is freely available. When you know the company, you check it about who are the directors of that company. What we just need is that the name of the companies that have done work in Pretoria and Cape Town. It was Kankurun. Announcement.
Thank you, Jefferson. Just one quick announcement, honorable members. The strip plans and APPs of the department, the DMT as well as the entities, were informed that they will be tabled to Parliament on Thursday, the 13th of the 12th. Yes, on Thursday. So we did then request some soft copies, which were promised to receive sometime later today by Vlad. We should then be in a position to send that through to members. And those will be dealt with on the 15th of April when we come back from recess. So on the 15th, our program looks something like the AG will give us a report in the morning. Then the department will give us an action plan on the audit outcome. That's the morning session. And then in the afternoon, we'll receive the stress plans and the APP presentation from the department and the TMT. Then the following day, which would be on a Thursday, we'll deal with the stress tests and the APPs of the entities, all of them on the same day. So we have two full day meetings when we come back from recess. Thank you, Chair.
Meeting with the judge.